strategies, one of the means of working with marginalization in terms of any form of identity, is to learn to own and appreciate that identity, you know, to fully accept every aspect of who you are, and let that be something that is fully a part of you, that's not put aside. At the same time, at the other end of the spectrum, the Buddha said, nothing whatsoever is to be clung to as I or mine. So on the one hand, the importance of a identity that you treasure, that you trust, that is your kind protector rather than a liability. On the other hand, eventually, the need to let go of all identities. You know, when most of you have heard the story several times already. When I first came out as gender fluid on retreat a few years ago, my teacher in my small group, Kamala Masters, was, you know, I was kind of moaning and, you know, whining about, you know, what a weird hand to get dealt, you know, to come out at 71 years of age, because otherwise, you know, things were not going well for me in terms of my mental health. And her saying, oh no, it's really wonderful karma, because you have the ability to experience both identities while still understanding that all identities are illusory. So it's a conundrum, you know? It's a koan. And that's what we're going to play with that weekend. We're going to be doing some journaling, some small group work, some Dharma talks, a lot of metta, loving kindness practice. So anyway, it's on a Dana basis. So please, if you're interested.
Where is that going to be?
At the Nalanda campus of Naropa University. And there are flyers on the back table. If you think you may want to do that. And the restorative yoga mindfulness meditation workshop I'm doing with Sarah Greenlee the first Saturday in June is full. And we've got a bit of a waiting list, but people always drop out, so if you're interested, still can go ahead and get a flyer. And if there's sufficient demand, then we might do it again, another one in a few months. So there's that. Okay, well, Jack Kornfield, one of my teachers, said once that, he's also a psychotherapist, said to follow the path of the Dharma is to give up all hope of ever having had a better past. It's a matter of learning to make peace with every aspect of who you are. There's a retreat that I co-taught with David Chernikoff a few years ago where we did an exercise similar to the one that we did when we were sitting tonight. And one of the reasons we felt it was important to do was something we'd both observed, either, you know, living in other cultures or being highly attuned to other ways that cultures go about raising their children. And one of the shadow sides, I think, that we both hold of modernity, of modern societies, is the relatively atomized social structure. Okay, so that because of the focus on the nuclear family to the exclusion of almost everything else, parents wind up having a strong, much more powerful influence on their children in terms of their children's view of themselves, in terms of how they're conditioned, of how they're raised, how their behavior is controlled, much more so than many other cultures. There are some other cultures, mostly non-literate ones, but in which parents play a relatively minor role in raising their kids. They get turned over to aunts and uncles and other people, or, you know, like Hillary Clinton's book, you know, It Takes a Village, of this idea that raising children is the responsibility of everybody in the community. And for some of us, maybe growing up in small towns quite a long time ago, there may have been that sense as well. You know, that a neighbor would be looking out for you if you got in trouble or misbehaved or something. And people would kind of look out for each other's kids. But not so much, with the result that parents wind up having a heck of an impact, for better or for worse, or both. There are other aspects of our culture that kind of tend to reinforce that as well. One of them is certainly in American society, well, we inherited a lot. One of the things we inherited from the Greeks was this notion of what's, ancient Greeks, this notion of what's called the great chain of being, right? That there's this hierarchical organization of all flora and fauna in terms of complexity. And that we sit atop that great chain of being. Okay. And that was a view that, you know, made its way through the Middle Ages and to modern time, and the church found that it came in very handy because they put man at the top of the great chain of being and then God just above that. So there was this hierarchy of how things were, hierarchy of authority, hierarchy of power. Okay. Getting forth into English society for a while, whenever there would be the head of a manor who would die off, they would evenly split the property among the kids. But since it's a landlocked country, you know, the more they did that, the smaller and smaller the pieces of land became until one couldn't make a living off it anymore. So instead, under British law, what they adopted was something called primogeniture. And what that means is that the entire landed estate of a family goes to the eldest son. And whether anybody else gets anything depends on what their relations are with the eldest son, who then takes over. But again, it reinforced this idea of a hierarchy, a patriarchal hierarchy. That's how the power was structured in the society. It tended to be how it was structured in families as well. And then on top of that, we have a worldview that we inherited that in Western religions and Middle Eastern religions, basically what we have is a once-through model, right, of humankind. We're born to some family of high birth or low birth or somewhere in between, and we live our lives and then we die. And depending on which religion you've signed up with, you either go to heaven or hell or nowhere at all. You know, you might just, maybe that's it, okay. Which is quite different from the Eastern view, especially that of Buddha Dharma. It sees the world differently, not in terms of some kind of hierarchy of beings at all, okay. And it understands or it suggests thinking about our relationships with those with whom we have a karmic linkage in very different ways. So the purpose of the exercise we did just now was an opportunity to take what we've learned about Buddha Dharma and use that to look back at the stories we've told ourselves over the course of our lives about our relationships with our parents. The things they did that we found beneficial, the things that they did that we found harmful. So looking back at it through the lens of the Dharma means also having some appreciation, whether you buy into it or not, about the nature of being itself. And the nature of being itself, from the Buddhist perspective, One really important concept or principle is that of dependent origination. It means that everything is continuously co-creating everything else all the time. That not only our own thoughts, you know, what we watch going on in the mind, but that's in fact the way the universe works. Everything is continuously in the process of arising and changing and passing away. And arising and changing and passing away. I know next to nothing about computer engineering, but to the little bit that I do know, I have this idea that basically the way information is stored and retrieved in microcomputer systems is that there are devices that are basically made up of matrices that have billions and billions of intersections. Okay. And that when someone is like operating a computer, you're putting in information, you're parking information in one of these little intersections, okay? And then you have an application that can go find it again when it needs to in order to do a certain job, okay? But one way of thinking about this view, this worldview, is this just great, vast network, okay? It's connected by pulses of energy in much the same way that a microcomputer might be. That there are pulses of energy coming from everywhere all the time that are going to specific directions for specific reasons. So it's also a way to understand the Buddha's teaching on rebirth. Not a self that's born again and again and again, but rather what is sometimes referred to as a continuity of causes and conditions. So in other words, if you think about the world in that way, and you think about yourself as one of those little intersections, right? Then we begin to have some appreciation for the myriad causes and conditions that gave rise to who we are at this point in time. Whether it's ethnic lineage, the socioeconomic status of the family we were born into, okay, the society that we were born into, the kind of environment we were born into, okay. I was born in Los Angeles, California, early in 1946, right after my dad got back from fighting in the South Pacific. There's a great housing shortage in Southern California. We lived in Long Beach. And we lived between a soap factory and an oil refinery. And the joke was, you always knew which way the wind was blowing. But we have a lot of epidemiological data now that says, all things being equal, when your mom was caring with you, it would have been a really good idea if she had access to wholesome, clean food and clean water and fresh air, right? So going back to there, those are among the circumstances that gave rise to who we were. We've learned enough about ourselves in studying the Dharma, practicing the Dharma, that we can see what gives rise to dukkha in the world, right? What gives rise to dukkha in our own minds? Attachment, aversion, and delusion. Okay. Where do our attachments, our delusions, our cravings, our aversions come from? They come from how we've been treated throughout our lives. So in some ways, early on, our parents, for the most part, were parenting us as they were parented. Or they were doing their best to parent us as differently as possible from how they were parented. And that's, in fact, has a lot to do with my own strategy as a parent. You know, there was enough that I didn't really care for about how I grew up, that I wanted to make sure that those qualities that I didn't particularly appreciate about my father were not ones that I would carry on. So at any rate, if we think about what are the causes and conditions that gave rise to we, all of these things, especially the influences, you know, the kind of the karmic imprint that became to some extent who we were, especially when we were children. Okay. Exactly the same thing was going on for our parents. And their parents. And their parents. And their parents. Right? So it's possible to kind of look back and look at the things that we don't particularly care for about how we were parented. From this point in time, and reflect on what was going on in their minds. What informed them about how to be with us, right? So this evening, maybe we had an opportunity to look back at our experiences having been raised by our parents through the lens of the Dharma. Sometimes, in so doing, it becomes possible to have insight into why they treated us in the ways they did, whether for better or for worse, right? Just as we gain insight into ourselves, under what circumstances are our words and deeds informed by beneficial intention? And in what instances are they not? You know, one of the kind of personal reflection questions that I found useful, I actually used to use it in my law classes, is asking people to ask themselves, who do you empower to improve of your actions?
To improve or approve?
Approve. Who do you empower to approve of your actions? So for instance, I was on the faculty of the University of Colorado. So I empowered the regents of the University of Colorado and the employment standards for being on the faculty, you know, I empowered that system. I gave them the right of approval over my behavior in return for me being on faculty, right? So some of us do that very openly and in kind of contractual terms when it comes to employment or to going to school. But there are other ways that we do it that are much more subtle, right? And unconscious. So one of those questions then, you can use that same question in relationship to our parents. During what periods of our lives did we seek most ardently for the approval of our parents? You know, we fully empowered them to approve of our actions because our very survival depended upon it, right? Growing up, moving away, to what extent does that karma still reside within us? To what extent is that approval seeking still there? The other question is, whom do I empower to tell me who I am? Whom do I empower to tell me who I am? When we were young, it was our parents, right? Because they were controlling our behavior in order to get us to do what they wanted us to do and keep us from doing what they didn't want us to do. Granting approval under some circumstances, withdrawing it under others. And so all of these things go into this relationship that we had growing up with our parents. You know, the difficult, the painful parts, the rewarding parts, and to a remarkable extent, it carries forward for the rest of our lives. You know. So Tara Brach in her book radical acceptance. She says, you know, what a lot of what the Dharma is about is what she calls reparenting, which is to say, learning how to be the parents to ourselves that we wish that we had had. What that requires is a lot of self-compassion. Because, like Jack said, it requires figuring out a way to make peace with those aspects of how we are raised that, on reflection and looking back, may well have harmed us or damaged us in some ways or caused us to build up some kind of a shell against what we perceive to be other threats that may arise in the environment that parallel those we may have experienced as a child. So looking back on our relationship, our history, the stories we tell ourselves about our histories with our parents, through the lens of the Dharma, are there any reflections or insights that come to mind that anyone might want to share, anything that came up while we were sitting? And you don't have to go deeply into your personal stories, but just, you know, things that came to mind in terms of the dynamic, you know, the karma that we inherited as a result of having the parents that we did. Please.
Before I forget what you said about dependent origination, I thought I would add insights that I learned from a shaman, a South American guy who was in Denver for 3 weeks. I put him up, learned a lot from him. And in a nutshell, when you were talking about the minute intersections of cause and effect, or of, I saw him as energy.
Yes, right. Really. Yeah.
He spoke of, in terms of DNA, mm-hmm. as it would relate to your parents. And he used the old-fashioned term, honor your ancestors. But as we worked together, I came to see that, you know, the ancestors, as accepting, understanding, accepting anyway, my own DNA in terms of how it related to my parents' DNA and their parents. And it put me in, it's kind of hard to describe, but it put me in that grid that you were describing when you were speaking of dependent origination. And it was life-changing to see my place in the march of generations as from the terms of DNA. Mm-hmm. That's the insight I got. It was a good one. Very useful.
Right. It's not exactly as if we had a chance to write our own code, is it? It's a hand we got dealt, right? The DNA.
It's a hand we got dealt, and therefore it absolves our parents, and it absolves ourselves of all the trips that we get into thinking about our folks. You know, it's DNA. And in his language, honor that. In our language, accept that.
Mm-hmm. Yes, please.
I think the thing that's so frustrating for me is that I can't separate out the things that I really don't like about myself and that I feel were the result of not terrific parenting from the things that are really I like about myself.
Yes.
I can't separate them.
Yes.
And there are times that I just want to say, I wish it had been different. But if it had been different, I wouldn't be me. And
yes.
So this is the terrible frustration is that how do I, if someone waved a magic wand and said, you can go back and change that thing your father did, the way he was or the way your mother was a doormat or whatever it was.
Right.
Well, yes, that might have been good, but it also means that I would be a completely different person. Do I want that? I don't think so.
Right.
So I don't know. It's just frustrating not to,
right.
to pull the threads out.
Yes.
Yeah.
So this business about, you know, giving up hope of ever having had a better past, the only thing we can do now about our own past is to inquire into the possibility of changing our relationship to it. And one of the ways that happens from the standpoint of the Dharma is to also take in and really give thought to the possibility that the Buddha was right when he said in his observation of things that there is no such thing as a permanent and abiding self. And that's where it was such a radical break with Brahmanism at the time. Because if in fact that's true, then we are not condemned to spend the rest of our lives wrestling with our personal histories. Because of the fact that rather being a static individual with this determinist history that we can do nothing about, we in fact are being rebirthed in every moment. And so part of the practice of Buddha Dharma is to learn to engage in conscious rebirthing. And part of that conscious rebirthing is looking back on our own karma. You know, there's some things, you know, my dad was a pretty rough disciplinarian. I was looking, he used to whip me pretty hard when I was like 4 and 5, 6, 7 years of age. And I would scream and cry. My mom would scream and cry. She didn't think it was a very good idea either. And the only way that she would console me was to say, well, you know, his father was much more violent to him, right? So that in fact, you know, it's kind of getting stepped down over the generations. And so there was, you'd get on one hand, you get this idea, you really should be closer to your extended family, right? Well, my dad's older brother and his kids and his wife came to visit us once, and we were going downtown, and his, you know, my cousins were about the same age as me, about 7 or so, and one of his daughters stood before a store where she saw something she wanted. She asked if she could go, and he said no, and he told her to come, you know, catch up with him, and she was a little slow doing it. He was 6'4" tall. The way he disciplined his kids was by beating him with his fists. And he came back to our home and did that. Right. And so I saw the tremendous physical violence ran in my father's family. You know, it's how they were all raised. They were all raised to be in terror of their fathers. Right. And so somehow it didn't make me feel a whole lot better when I was a little kid, but in retrospect, and you know, and in fact, you know, it's one of the things I swore to myself I was never going to do as a parent myself. But it brought forth in me the need to hold that relationship and those memories from the perspective of the Dharma, you know, and to see whether it might be possible. Sometimes I would find myself able to forgive them, other times not, you know. It's really important, as Tara Brach says, when you've had those kinds of violent or extremely unwholesome interactions with parents at an early age in particular, you know, various kinds of abuse and whatnot, to not to try to force yourself to forgive if that's not really there. Because if it's not in you to forgive, that is your Dharma, that's your truth right now. you know, you're holding that pain, but it's not something that you're at this state at a particular point in time able to let go of through forgiveness, whether it's a father or a mother that did something profoundly hurtful. Okay, yeah, please.
You know, what comes up is, I remember a couple years ago, Richie Gates and Daniel Goleman, Alter Traits, the book, something to that effect, the title, and based on Davidson's research at University of Wisconsin, as I understood it, they looked at meditation practices as being ways that literally alter brain structures. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's another, it's not just sort of psychological understanding, but these practices that alter our states of mind eventually alter our traits.
Exactly.
And gene expression is something that literally is available to us.
Yes, yes, thank you very much. If we are able to take in and view the world from the standpoint of us rebirthing ourselves, right, moment to moment to moment, then looking back on our own histories, it's possible for us to hold in our hearts with tremendous compassion the child that we were when that was going on. Oh, look at that, okay. To look at what could possibly have been in the minds of our parents when they were doing that, right? They were living in hell. They, you know, for the unskillful things that were done, they were likewise, you know, in the throes of major dukkha, you know. And for people that work with folks that have been subject to abuse, domestic abuse, you know, it runs through families, you know. It's much more likely that someone who is abused as a child is going to be an abuser, whether it's of a domestic partner or a child. Okay, it's the sort of the karmic imprint. So what we're doing is looking back, who were we when we underwent that? Who were they, you know? And so at some point, at some time, then without compelling or trying to force yourself to do it, forgiveness does eventually begin to become more available. Okay. There's a poem by a fellow named Dick Laurie that I like in this regard. It says, how do we forgive our fathers? Maybe in a dream. Do we forgive our fathers for leaving us too often or forever when we were little? Maybe for scaring us with unexpected rage or making us nervous because there never seemed to be any rage there at all. Do we forgive our fathers for marrying or not marrying our mothers, for divorcing or not divorcing our mothers? And shall we forgive them for their excesses of warmth or of coldness? Shall we forgive them for pushing or leaning, for shutting doors, for speaking through walls, or never speaking, or never being silent? Do we forgive our fathers in our age or theirs, or in their deaths, saying it to them or not saying it? If we forgive our fathers, what is left?
When there was the exercise, what unskillful things did your mother do? An image came to me of when I was a little kid, and our kitchen was open to the breakfast room where me and my brothers were eating lunch. And my stepmom gave me a pastrami sandwich, and when I was a kid, I didn't like spicy things. So the garage was right next door, and the garbage can was right outside that. So I sort of looked over at her and went, oh, she's not looking. And I went and flipped the sandwich in the garbage. But my stepmom saw me do that, so she made me take it out of the garbage and eat it. But, you know, so I was thinking of that skillful thing she was doing, but then I thought of that whole dynamic that I was a rebellious kid, so instead of saying, Mom, I don't like the sandwich. What I would do is, you know, do something covert like that. So that's sort of how our relationship went, you know. And at a certain point later, I think I was also that way with my father, that rebellious thing. And I thought I was doing it my way, but I realized I was being controlled by that. If my father wanted me to do one thing, I was doing the opposite. So that was really controlling things. And after getting a little bit more mature and practicing, I finally recognized that and, you know, finally let go of that sort of thing.
Yeah, thank you.
You know, but when I grew up, I did start eating my vegetables, which we would have big, huge family fights over, so.
One of the lines in this poem that really has stayed with me is the last one, where he says, if we forgive our fathers, what is left?
Right? I don't understand that.
I think what he's trying to get at is that for those of us who still have perhaps considerable charge in terms of difficult or painful karmic relationships with parents, if we get to the point of being able to forgive, of letting go of those memories, in a way it's like letting go of them. That carrying the pain is a way of continuing to be in touch with them, as strange as it sounds. Okay. But to let go into forgiveness is also to let go of that connection. Whoever that person was, when they did that, they're gone now. You know, they've been released into infinity, just as we all will be, right? And insofar as self-care going forward, okay, it's like carrying around a hot coal. there are other ways to warm yourself that don't involve burning yourself. And so that, when we talk about bringing the Dharma to bear, it's that, you know, it's as it becomes possible to do. Okay. Forgiving our parents, whoever they were when they did that, to the extent that we can, is like Sylvia Boorstein says, it's the price of freedom. Forgiveness is the price of freedom. Okay. Which is not to berate yourself if it's not possible. It's just to acknowledge that at a particular point in time, for a particular act, it's not possible. Yeah.
You know, the notion of forgiveness carries with it this idea that whatever it was you did to me, it's okay. But it wasn't okay.
No.
And it had consequences. I remember one incident in particular that occurred when I was on a 3-month retreat. You know how sometimes insights come to you while you're sitting, and other times insights come to you when you're washing dishes or whatever.
Yes.
But I was having my lunch, and suddenly, what came to my mind was something that happened to me when I was 7 years old. And what I found with meditation is that when you have one of those kind of memories, it presents itself, I called it holographically. In other words, you totally re-experience it.
Yes.
You're the little kid whose mother is yelling at you for whatever it was. You remember it as though you are there right now.
Yes.
And in so doing, just the act of letting go is forgiveness.
Yes.
You're able to let go by seeing it.
Yes.
Right? And that is how I would like to interpret forgiveness. I mean, what she did back then was really unforgivable when you consider the dynamics.
Yes.
But nonetheless, it no longer affects me. I remember it, but I don't, I'm not. The interesting thing about that particular incident was that down through the years that followed, it colored every interaction, and yet I never knew that that was the origin of.
Yes, yes, right. Yeah, these things can go incredibly deep, and it's oftentimes it takes something like a retreat for them to be released and for the connection to make itself apparent.
I wanted to say one other thing that I found really helpful on retreat, and that was something that Michelle McDonald said. She said that she could encapsulate her entire neuroses in three words. Don't leave me. Isn't that amazing? So after that retreat, I started asking my friends, give me, you know, your core neurosis in three words.
Yeah.
I got things like, you're no good.
Yes.
I can't decide. Mine was, don't grow up.
Don't grow up.
Remain a child.
So you'll be cared for? Or?
No, more like so that you'll do as you're told.
Oh, okay. All right. Yeah, very good. Thank you. When I was about 12, my parents' marriage was beginning to disintegrate, and things get very tense. They didn't actually fight very much, but every once in a while it would kind of burst forth. And we lived in the desert in the Tucson Mountains, and I was very shaken. You know, we lived in this remote place out in the mountains, and there wasn't anywhere to go. You know, so I just went out on the front porch, and I sat down. It happened to be sunset, and it was just this really beautiful sunset that just kind of, I found myself just kind of being drawn into it a little bit. And then it was as if there was a presence next to me that was saying, it's okay, it's going to be all right. You'll get through this. Many, many years later, I was on a retreat with a Dzogchen teacher and down at the retreat center in Pagosa Springs, Taramandala. And the Dzogchen teacher had us go out and sit on the hillside at sunset and watch the sunset. And the same thing would happen. The mind would just expanded into the void, you know. And what happened for me right now, right then, was sitting next to myself on the porch at 12, comforting myself, saying, it's going to be okay. You'll get through this. Exactly the same thing, yeah. And so, for me, that experience has really compelled keeping an open mind about a lot of things. But among them is this actually, this ability to go back and be with or be that person. So when Tara talks about reparenting, she's talking about that. All the ways that we were harmed or troubled or afraid, you know, it's within our capacity in the Dharma to be with that person, to parent, to be with that aspect of ourselves in a way that our parents were incapable of, or even if they were doing us positive harm. It really is possible for us to use the Dharma to heal from that experience. So let's take just a moment, if we can, and take our sitting posture once more. May we all live with ease. Enjoy ease of well-being. Be safe from all inner and outer harm. fully accepting every aspect of who we are, opening our hearts to ourselves. Being the loving and compassionate and supportive and caring parent to the small child that still resides within us. Thanks for coming around. Hope to see you at BASEFACT.
Thank you.